Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This past year was a roller coaster ride for communities across the Northwest fighting major frack gas infrastructure projects. On the one hand, scientifically baseless environmental impact statements were submitted for the Kalama methanol and approved for Tacoma LNG. On the other hand, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee came out against both those projects last spring, and the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality denied a necessary permit for Jordan Cove LNG, and the wheels kept turning until the end of the year. Today, we look back at 2019 and ahead to 2020 with Eric DePlace, director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle. We'll talk about the successes and frustrations of the past year and what to expect as we head into 2020. Eric, welcome back to Locust Focus.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's always good to talk with you.
Well, I sort of consider you one of my co-hosts, actually. So.
good.
And maybe this will be a tradition. This is the second year now that we're starting the year by looking back at the past year together.
Right.
So, and you started an article that you published on the Sightline website last week with, if you're desperate for good news about climate change, it helps to have a sense of schadenfreude. So what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, the news on climate is pretty grim right now. I think everyone knows that, and I'm sure we'll have time to talk about that a little more fully later in the program today. But, you know, as dire as the climate crisis is right now, there are rays of good hope or of good news in the suffering, the financial suffering of some of the companies that are responsible for it. So in this last year, we really saw the case for fracking, sort of the energy-related case and the moral case, and then the financial case just disintegrate on those companies. And so you've got a whole bunch of gas producers who are taking huge losses on their books. Chevron had to write down, I think, $10 or $11 billion last year toward the end of the year. And so we're seeing that the financial sector is really starting to crank up the pain on the fracking industry and the oil and gas industry. And so if you have a sense of schadenfreude, if you take delight in other people's suffering in a strange way, that's actually sort of good news.
Well, I think that we'll touch on that again in a little bit. I'm sort of thinking picturing the whole year, what I keep having in my eyes is the cover of Time magazine with Person of the Year, Greta Thunberg, and thinking about how just a little over a year ago, it was really hard to get the mainstream media to really focus on climate change. It's still hard in a lot of ways to get the politicians and the people who really could make an impact on addressing climate change to really take it seriously. But somehow, having Greta up there made me a little bit more hopeful. I wonder if that image resonates for you in terms of a turning point that happened in the past year.
I think it's a turning point. I hope it's a turning point, I guess I should say. I mean... It's tinged with so much sort of despair and grief on my part that we're at this point already. But I do think that sort of the moral, the banner or something belongs with Greta's generation. And so it is exciting to see her get that kind of recognition. Obviously, there are big cross currents that she and her generation and all the rest of us have to face, too. But I'm hopeful, modestly hopeful, but scared too, frankly.
Well, there's a lot to be scared about. Actually, I talked to Patrick Mazza, who was formerly of Portland, now lives in Seattle, on the phone yesterday. We hadn't talked in a really long time, and so I think I might have wished him a happy new year. And he says, "Yes, as the world is about to end." And I think, and we maybe want to touch a little bit on kind of what's going on there, the big elephant in the room right now that maybe will impact everything that we're trying to do on a local level, but maybe not. And that's one of the things I wanted to look at. But I guess we should acknowledge that this is the first show of the year, and we're looking at maybe a major war happening in the Middle East. On the other hand, I was reading articles today before I came in that make it look like there's not as much unity on the part of the Trump administration to support this crazy thing that he did over the weekend in basically trying to start a war. So I guess I wonder, in the face of maybe having to start another anti-war movement, which I think is already kicked into gear, how does that fold into the fight against all the other things that we're fighting about, particularly around the fossil fuel struggle here in the Northwest and the whole way of having to address climate change and the fact that this existential reality that we are facing?
Well, I'm always glad to come on your show, Barbara, because you ask such easy questions. Yikes, that is a tall order. That was, You know, I think in some ways they're all linked together. We have I don't know. I mean, I don't have the first inkling how the situation in the Middle East will play out, nor how the very concerning actions by the U.S. Will or will not result in a war, and what the backlash to that might look like. But I think it's increasingly clear that there are huge segments of the American public and the global public that do not want more conflict in the Middle East, particularly not of this variety. And you know, in a sort of an indirect but still, I think a serious way, it is linked up with these big challenges of climate change. In at least the sense that we live now in a world where we're all connected, whether we want to be or not. There is no such thing as saying, you know, look, you can go have your problems over there, but I'm going to, you know, keep my little peaceable kingdom over here. That era is, I think, long gone now. And so there's a very real sense that, you know, what the U.S. does in Iraq or Iran is relevant to those of us in the Northwest, just as fracking in the Permian Basin or elsewhere is relevant to us in the Northwest. And so, you know, there is, you know, we used to sort of say, I mean, decades ago, there was a lot of talk about act locally and think globally. And that's really become, it's impossible not to act globally. Almost everything we do now does in some way have global significance. And by the same token, actions elsewhere have local significance. And so we're kind of inhabiting a brave new world in that sense.
Well, I was actually thinking yesterday, I was listening to the radio and kind of yelling at it, listening to, I think it was a Republican in the Congress defending this attack on Iran, and also defending the possibility that we might go ahead and bomb cultural sites, basically saying he hadn't read the details on that yet. So as I'm listening to that and fuming to myself, I started having this mantra, intersectionality, that I feel like, for me, I really want to keep focus on the work that we've been doing here for the last few years locally to really build up this region, at the same time making links to why... Well, I mean, there is a lot of connection. A whole lot of it has to do with fossil fuel, and why are we going after Iran as opposed to going after New Zealand, let's say. So these are the thoughts of, like, how do we keep that in mind? How do we keep the connection to everything together as we strive to head forward?
Yeah, I think that's a really good insight, and I do think it is important and right that the world that, you know, many progressives are striving for, and many of the most intersectional progressives are striving for, is a world that is a lot more peaceful and just and sustainable. And so, you know, it's very hard to solve the climate crisis without also, addressing problems with our democracy and addressing our sort of, you know, overly militaristic posture elsewhere. And by the same token, you know, it's hard to solve any one of those problems in isolation. And so, you know, if we are successful on some level in modulating or addressing the effects of climate change, that's going to mean kind of creating a world that's better in a lot of different ways. And so I think we do need very much to keep in mind the intersectionality of all of the parts of our movement and all the players in our movement. We've got a big, huge, diverse movement regionally and globally, and I think that's our biggest asset.
Actually, the other day, I guess it was right after the attack on Iran, I saw a Facebook post by Damon Montstori, who works with Physicians for Social Responsibility here in Oregon. And I think of him mainly as being a climate activist. And there he was in the front of this photo of people protesting in front of, downtown against the war or the impending war. And I thought, perfect. I mean, this is really something where it's the same as when... families were being separated at the border a year and a half ago, and people who were real involved with the climate movement became really involved in fighting for the rights for immigrants. So I see that it's happening. It's maybe always been happening in a way, but I wonder, I mean, I think about the 90s and the 80s were times of real silo politics where people just basically had their own issues, and it seemed to start changing at the WTO demonstrations in Seattle in 1999. How do you see that there are actually these intersections are starting to congeal in some ways and become more of a part of a solid whole?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, I, and this sounds a little bit corny, but it's totally true. I think the best evidence of that is if you walk into a classroom right now and you talk to the kids in those classrooms. My son's in fifth grade, and you walk into his fifth grade classroom and you just start talking to those kids about climate change or any of those issues that we've mentioned, they don't see them as distinct sort of siloed issues, and they talk about them a lot, believe me. I mean, in fifth grade right now, those kids are very worried about climate change. They get it in a way that maybe even we don't, and it's a tragedy. They are growing up into an emerging tragedy, but they see those issues all connected, of immigration, of militarism, of justice for LGBTQ people, and it's all linked. And it really is all linked. And so I think that the mindset that they inhabit is, as you say, very different from the mindset that we had, you know, during the 80s and the 90s when we did tend to be a little more siloed, and there were some sort of alliances and some crossover, but we more focused on individual issues. And I think that's changed now. I think mostly that's for the good. I do worry that it sort of reflects or even maybe accelerates this really concerning polarization in our country, where you've kind of got, you know, half the country that's becoming more progressive and half the country that's becoming more conservative, with increasingly few links between them. But nonetheless, I do think that there's real sort of power in what feels to me like a new mindset altogether. Like it's not the sort of mental model, the political model that I grew up with or came of age with at all.
Yeah, well, what was that? I mean, what's the difference? I keep thinking about another line that I used to hear a lot. This was actually back in the late 90s, which was, there's no more left and right. It's now up and down. You have to look at totally class, which really annoyed me, because I thought, that's kind of mindless in a way. And you can get into some real dangerous right-wing populism when you have that mindset. But what is the difference, do you think, between the kind of political attitudes that you were growing up with and what you see your son growing up with now?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I really have a complete answer to that at all. But you know, it feels to me that maybe this is a partial answer to it. The sort of mental political model that I grew up with, I was born in 1973, was that nuclear Armageddon was right around the corner. That we were going to practice in school to somehow survive a nuclear strike. I mean, that was ridiculous, but it happened, and we lived under that cloud as kids, believing that, you know, Red Dawn was going to come one of these days. And then by the time I was a sophomore in high school, it felt like out of the blue, the Berlin Wall fell down, it was taken down. And it wasn't like, you know, there wasn't the end of history a la Francis Fukuyama or anything like that, but it did feel like, oh my gosh, this existential threat, this cloud that we've lived under our whole lives is gone, and it's possible to make progress, and maybe through fits and starts and, you know, we could create through political will a better world. And that sort of that model kind of has informed, I think, most of my thinking up until quite recently, frankly. That's not the model that I think this generation is coming of age with politically or sort of morally. It is a very sort of different environment. You know, part of that is the occupant of the White House right now. Part of it, I think, is the horrifying injustice of some of the treatment we've seen of people's, like the child separation policy at the border is a great example of that. I'd almost forgotten about that in a weird way.
There's been so many horrible things since.
Right. And then the sense that climate change is, this is something that's broken in a way that cannot really be put right. And we don't know how bad it's going to get, but something's gotten broken. And they're growing up into a world of with that sensibility, I think.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle. Well, you're describing growing up with the fears of nuclear holocaust. And actually, I remember those fears very well back at the time you were talking about in the late 70s, early 80s. But when I was growing up, which is 20 years earlier than that, we were also growing up with the sense of nuclear holocaust, and that really shadowed my childhood. I mean, I think about that a lot. And I've had conversations with young people about, like, well, what's worse, growing up with a fear of nuclear war or growing up with the fear of total climate chaos. And my thought, and I sort of get it from young people, is what's happening now is way worse in a way than growing up with a fear of nuclear holocaust, because the nuclear holocaust could be prevented by us not exploding bombs, basically, which seems more doable than what we're facing now. I'm wondering if you have a similar sense, or if you see that maybe what you grew up with is not quite as is in its own way is equally horrifying as what your son's growing up with.
Yeah, I think the short answer is that I kind of share your view that this is grimmer. I mean, I don't know. I can't remember exactly what it was like to be a kid believing that we were all going to get wiped out. But this is grim. And so there are two articles that I'm telling everyone to read right now, and they bear directly on this question. But I want to have a chance to sort of tell the audience about them. It's important that you read them in this order. So the first one is David Roberts' latest at Vox. It's called "The Sad Truth About Our Boldest Climate Target." And it's a pretty clear-eyed assessment of where we are with respect to hitting our climate targets and kind of what that means. And it's sort of a just-the-facts approach, and it's not likely to make anybody super happy. After you read that, then I highly recommend reading Rebecca Solnit's latest, which is called "Letter to a Young Climate Activist on the First Day of the New Decade." And that, curiously enough, does have quite a bit of hope in it. Not about fixing climate change, but about what our responsibilities are and the beauty we can still find in the world. And so I'm hoping that my son and his generation are able to see with clear eyes about what the world is becoming, and also inhabit the sort of moral universe that Rebecca Solnit describes in her piece. It's just really, really good, and it talks about that threat of nuclear Armageddon.
Well, could you send me those links, and I'll put them on the Locus Focus website this afternoon?
Certainly will, yes.
Okay, well, like I definitely want to read them myself. Well, speaking of articles that everybody should read, and it seems like everybody has read, and this gets back to the Schadenfreude that you were talking about, and it's a kind of mixed bag about that, but the Seattle Times ran a very interesting article a couple weeks ago, which we talked a little bit about in the show then, about how the gas industry in the Northwest is putting together a major PR campaign to promote natural gas as a clean green fuel, and that needs to be a very important part of our portfolio as we challenge climate change, and that they see their spokesman for this PR campaign sees the attack on the part of the climate movement on natural gas as an existential threat to the fossil fuel industry. So I wanted to talk a bit about what you, first of all, what's in that article, and then what that might be saying that goes along with what you started out the show talking about, the fact that the frack gas industry is taking some major financial hits now.
Yeah, I mean, so it's lovely when I can agree with the spokespeople for the gas industry, because he's totally right. Like the Northwest climate movement is an existential threat to the gas industry, and we're going to win that fight. And so if I were the gas industry, I'd be freaked out too. And they're going to spend $1 million. This article explains, and you just mentioned it. And they're going to spend $1 million at least on a PR offensive. To basically make the case that fracked gas is a good deal economically and environmentally and who knows what else. I have a little bit of insight into what they're planning to do. But this is great evidence that the fossil fuel industry knows it is squarely in the crosshairs. And now in other regions, they're in less trouble. They're still in trouble everywhere, but they're in less trouble. In the Northwest, I think they're in serious trouble, and I welcome that fight. I think this is a great next chapter for the Northwest climate movement, for the resistance to fossil fuel infrastructure. As we've talked about many times in this show, I mean, this movement has knocked down coal terminals, oil trains, pipelines, you name it, over and over again. And now the movement is turning its sights on gas, and I think it is very likely that within this next year and in the years that follow, the gas industry in the Northwest is going to take some major hits. We're going to see them get unwound, their tentacles get sort of untangled from our politics and our economy, and we're going to start seeing cities either straight up ban new gas infrastructure or start to delete parts of it, or start to do other things to really make gas untenable into the future.
Well, it seems that there's two initiatives in particular that are freaking out the gas companies in the Northwest, and one is that in Seattle, there was a proposal that I guess got tabled to ban gas heating in any future, any new construction. The one that I think really has people really concerned, and there was an article about in the New York Times yesterday, is in Bellingham, they are talking about banning any gas heating in residential, low-rise residential buildings by 2030 or 2035. So let's talk a bit about those initiatives and why they are, how they've gotten, we've come to the point where we're actually having those initiatives, if they're a good idea, and why they're such a threat to the gas company.
Yeah, I mean, so great question. I mean, and I would say even preliminary to those features that you just mentioned, there's this overarching one, which is the gas industry knows right now that it cannot get a new project built. There is no way they could come to the table now with a new project proposal and have any chance of getting it built. The only projects that are still out there, Jordan Cove, LNG, and Clemmer Methanol, a couple little ones, those were proposed a long time ago. They slipped through some early phases of permitting and review, but the world has turned against them, at least in this region. And so they're at a place where, you know, like sort of the conventional model of expansion is already off the table for them. So then it starts looking like, well, what is the gas supply to maybe existing power plants? That's under threat. What is the gas supply to buildings, mostly in cities? And that's under threat too. And if they cannot continue growing, it's not like they just reach a stasis. They actually financially get into very serious trouble if their growth model doesn't continue. But I'm not talking about just stopping there. And I think most people aren't talking about stopping their growth. I'm talking about actually walking them back quite a long ways. And so I'm glad you mentioned that article in the New York Times about Bellingham, because it's a great one. I talk to the activists up there pretty regularly, and there's a really robust political movement there that could easily accomplish what they've set out to do. And that is saying, look, you know, gas in buildings is done by, you know, we'll set a date and it's going to happen by then. Other cities like Seattle and a bunch of cities in California, there's a couple in Massachusetts too, have said we're going to start banning new hookups for gas. So in any new development, you can't add gas to it. Seattle didn't go anywhere last year. It may come back. Who knows?
But Michael Bryan was the city councilman who proposed that, right?
That's correct. And he has now stepped out of office. So the mantle will go to somebody else now.
And you think the mantle will go to somebody else, or is going to die with Mike's leaving office?
I don't think it'll die. I think it will come back in a form that's reconfigured with more political buy-in from housing developers and unions and some equity communities, and that first proposal I think was pretty good, but didn't have kind of the political building blocks in place to make it happen. It's very possible to do something like that in Seattle, but you have to assemble the pieces first. And so I would expect that, you know, sometime in 2020, probably late 2020, that's back on the table.
Now, how about Bellingham? I'm wondering what you think about that proposal, because it got an interesting analysis in the Times article, and some of it, I mean, I had some concerns. I mean, because it would affect, if I lived in Bellingham with my current house, it would affect me. And it looked like it was in a timeline where it might be a little premature for me to get a new gas furnace or getting a new furnace. So I'm concerned about some of the parts of that and how that really plays out in terms of it being really doable for people who aren't relatively well off to make that conversion to away from gas to electricity in the next 15 years.
Yeah. So I think that's a great question to ask about this. It's one thing to sort of say, well, we're gonna ban new hookups, so any new developments can't have gas; they have to be clean electricity. That's relatively achievable. Then this harder question is, well, how do you phase out gas in existing buildings, and how do you do it in a way that isn't sort of financially punitive for people who have existing gas hookups and need to make a transition? And I don't know that Bellingham has the details of that sorted out in just the right way yet. And I'm not actually deep enough on that city's policies. I do know it is accomplishable. I mean, somebody is going to have to bear that cost. In my view, the entity that should bear that cost is actually the gas utility itself. The gas industry should be paying to make the transition away from gas. And I do think it is possible to accomplish that And without kind of wandering too far into the weeds, I've been writing a series at Sightline that seems really deep in the weeds, but it bears on this question. And that's, can we use utility taxes and what are called franchise fees? These are fees that are basically levied by local governments on utilities to use public right-of-way. These two pricing mechanisms can be used then on the gas industry to fund a transition to clean energy. Eugene actually is probably the regional leader, maybe the national leader on this right now. They're in negotiations. And I wouldn't be surprised if you get some, you know, those kind of mid-sized cities like Eugene, Bellingham, some others that are starting to experiment and starting to do some really aggressive, assertive stuff. And we're not going to get it right the first or the second time, but we'll get it right the third or the fourth time, fifth time. And I think this is the kind of stuff that just puts the fear into the gas industry because it's out of their hands now.
So let's get back to this article that was in the Seattle Times about the gas industry gearing up to confront this existential threat. What are they going to be doing to fight back? I think that people who live in Tacoma are very familiar with these glossy mailers that you get periodically from Puget Sound Energy telling them how great Tacoma LNG would be and how great Puget Sound Energy is. And people down in Southern Oregon can go on. My friends down there refer to them as giant Hallmark cards that they're constantly getting from Pembina, who now owns Jordan Cove. So there's a certain number of people who will see these glossy mailers or this glossy campaign and see right through it. But do you think that there are people, particularly the targeted suburban housewives that this campaign is targeting, do you think that they might be susceptible to this kind of propaganda?
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes. I mean, the gas industry is pretty good at this stuff. I mean, and you just mentioned two great examples of it. I mean, and they'll you know, I'm sure they'll come out with lots of glossy photos of people sitting in front of a gas fireplace or cooking on their gas stove, or and they'll probably do some emergency preparedness stuff. And I mean, we know sort of what their playbook is going to be, and that's fine. That's good because we actually do need to. Those are real lifestyle choices and real issues that real people deal with. And it's suburban, it's rural, it's urban too. We need to have that conversation. We need to have that conversation four square, front and center, in a really robust way. And so I think it is a great opportunity for this region to start that debate. And let's do it in Bellingham and Eugene and Seattle and Portland and Tacoma. And I'm telling you right now on January 6th, where I can be held to account later on, we're going to win that fight. We are definitely going to win that fight in the Northwest. And it's because we have the moral urgency of climate change on our side. It's because the impacts of fracking are atrocious. And it's because burning gas indoors is actually not such a healthy choice. And so I think when we have an opportunity to make our case in public, and this region has an advocacy community that can force that conversation into the public square, I think we're going to win. And so they're welcome to waste $1 million on provoking a conversation that we should be having anyway. But I think they're in real trouble.
Well, actually, I see that this conversation was really kick-started many years ago down in Southern Oregon, where they've been fighting Jordan Cove for more than 15 years. But it's also in Washington with the frack gas projects that were proposed, particularly in Tacoma and in Kalama, that people have really learned a lot about the gas industry, about fracking, about, you know, just how polluting and how carbon intensive natural gas really is. So that this seems to me that the people who the climate movement actually has a leg up on the gas industry in terms of holding their own, if not dominating the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And I mean, so if you look at sort of national public opinion research on the way people think about, you know, even if you call it quote unquote natural gas or fracking or any of that stuff, public opinion is moving hard against the gas industry on this stuff. It used to be that people had, in general, a very favorable view, and that's not the case anymore. So there's a Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania does these annual surveys of public opinion in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is the second largest gas producer right now in the country after Texas. Portions of that state are covered with frack wells. And a few years ago, I mean, I'm talking 2015, 2016, public opinion in Pennsylvania was pretty supportive, 60s, even 70% for gas extraction. And on every measure of public opinion about gas, and they measure a few every year the same way. They're cratering. The gas industry is cratering. They're down, you know, well below 50% now, and looks like the line is just kind of falling off a cliff. And so it's become clear, I think, to people that you know, gas is not the answer to the future, and we have to make a transition away from it. That's the public opinion side. And then on the finance side, Wall Street has gotten very skeptical about the oil and gas industry's ability to make money. You know, they're not so much in it for the altruistic reasons, but they're not loving the gas industry right now, and they're punishing some of those companies financially, and which is great. So they're kind of caught between a couple of big challenges, and I think, you know, it's hard to see, even if you get the Trump administration back in for a second term, God forbid. But even if that happens, I think it's very difficult to imagine how they survive, for the next few years.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute. We're talking about the rough road ahead for the frack gas industry in 2020. But let's talk a little bit about why it's been so rough in the past year for them. And let's kind of do a little review of the major frack gas projects here in the Northwest and the ups and downs. I guess starting with, I'm sort of remembering, dramatic things started happening in March and April last year where there was actually some denials and some turnarounds, particularly around, Jordan Cove and also with the gas projects in Washington State. So let's kind of review what happened and how some key politicians have also shifted their positions.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we start sort of at the high level, we entered 2019. So a year ago, we're looking at the kind of, the map of the Northwest, the chessboard map of the Northwest, and we've got two really big gas infrastructure projects on the table. We've got the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas export project in Coos Bay. We've got the Klamath methanol project in Washington on the Columbia River, which basically pipes in a huge amount of gas and converts it to a liquid petrochemical. And then some other smaller but still significant ones. There's the Tacoma LNG project on Puyallup tribal homelands. There's a gas pipeline expansion in Snohomish County just north of Seattle. A few others. And
actually, I'm going to add one more, because there was also the proposed methanol refinery to be the sister plant to the Klamath one right across the river, just outside of Clatskanie, Oregon. And that was still and that was still going on last January.
How quickly I forget.
And why did we forget about that one? What happened there?
Right. I mean, that's a good place to start. I mean, so the project backers, were looking at the long-term financial opportunity for converting gas to methanol and selling that to China for plastics, and they were looking at the opposition movement in the Northwest, and it wasn't a close call. They had to pull that one off. So that was, I mean, in some ways, that was the first and most significant victory of 2019. Is that was an enormous project, and it's gone now, and it's not going to come back, in my judgment. So that's huge. And that is, there are, as with any of these fights and in these infrastructure fights, there are multiple pressures and multiple forces acting on them, and that one went away. And actually, another one that went away, and this is sort of skipping to a smaller project, but up in Anacortes, there was a xylene project, which is a petrochemical project, also designed for plastics in China, and that was mostly derived from oil rather than gas, but. After a long-term, 4 or 5 year fight, plus some legal challenges, plus some market challenges, the refinery in Anacortes pulled that project as well. So that one's off the table too.
Those are kind of the bookends for 2019, actually, because that just happened recently, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So we began and ended the year with victories, and then what happened in between?
What happened in between? And you may have to refresh my memory on some of this, Barbara. So, but we can work through it together. I think at a high level, every single one of these projects ends up delayed, over budget, and uncertain. With the possible Tacoma gets delayed, That one may actually get permitted and go all the way through, but it's still going to face some legal challenges. Every single one of these projects is years behind schedule, way over budget, politically unpopular, subject to ongoing legal challenges and uncertainty. And so, you know, it's a kind of a nightmarish quagmire situation that the gas industry is in with every single one of these projects that have come up. And one of the interesting things that happened in 2019, from my point of view, is that Governor Inslee, who had originally actually supported Coloma methanol and was sort of tacitly supporting Tacoma LNG, he went on the presidential campaign trail and also, I think, was sort of got religion about what the significance of these projects was. He switched. He switched and said, look, I'm opposing, we have to stop Coloma methanol, we should stop Tacoma LNG. And so now, you know, the governor's office in Washington is foursquare against those kind of expansions. That's a big political shift, and I think it's sort of more evidence for this notion I mentioned earlier that, you know, if you're the gas industry, you could not now in 2020 bring a new project to the table. It wouldn't go anywhere. And that wasn't true even a few years ago. Even in early 2019, that wasn't true.
Now, actually, with Inslee's switch, I'm thinking that we've seen some actual action that is sort of in following the tone of his statement that he made last April, I think it was, March or April. So we're seeing that in Coloma. We're not seeing that in Tacoma. So let's talk a bit about what's going on now with Coloma and that disastrous environmental impact statement that was released a little over a year ago, was heavily debated, and then they re-released the one that had been completely punctured with holes by all kinds of experts. They re-released it as a final supplemental environmental impact statement in a few months ago. So where does that stand now?
So I think that was a great summary of the just horrifically flawed environmental impact statements. But that project too now is going to be delayed another year at least, because, and I may get the details wrong, and I apologize to everyone who's closely involved in that fight. But I mean, there's a legal challenge on the contents of that analysis, and so it's going to have to go back for more review with specific attention to some of the most glaring flaws in that greenhouse gas analysis. And Barbara, I don't know, maybe you have more information about that. I actually don't at my fingertips right this second, but I think what it points out to me is that we have these tools. We have got these environmental impact analyses that can do some important work in terms of informing the public about the impacts of a project. That's useful. It's more useful if they actually do the math right, which they don't always do, and that was a great example of it. But ultimately, that tool is not the kind of tool that we need now. That tool was sort of designed decades ago for different challenges. And so, in my judgment, what we need for a tool that will adequately address these projects is something that looks more like a climate test, or something that looks more like just a straight-up ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure. And we don't have that yet. We don't really know what that tool looks like yet, but I think it's sort of the moment to build that, you know, in the next couple of years, so that when we're confronted with an obviously stupid project like Coloma methanol, it doesn't sort of get as far down the road as this one has gotten. That's kind of a nebulous statement, but that's kind of where my head is on that one.
Well, some of the specifics about Coloma methanol, as I understand it, is that the Department of Ecology basically rejected the final supplemental environmental impact statement that had been written by Northwest Innovation Works, the company that wants to build the methanol refinery, and the Cowlitz County and the Port of Coloma. And the Department of Ecology said that they needed to address all the issues that the opponents of the project have been raising, particularly around the actual greenhouse gas emissions, the leakage, and other things that they were ignoring and using very strange numbers, and also the other pollution aspects, and also the concern about whether this methanol would be used for fuel as opposed to being used as a precursor for plastics. So the response that the company gave to the Department of Ecology was, we think we did a great job and it's very transparent. We answered all your questions and we're not going to do anything else. So the Department of Ecology said, okay, we're going to rewrite the environmental impact statement. So basically, NWIW is taken out of the loop, and the Department of Ecology is going to be writing an environmental impact statement that it seems pretty likely, judging from their comments on the other environmental impact statements and other comments that they've made, it's going to be something that I think someone like you, Eric Deplace, is going to really like. So it seems to me, so my sense is that the Kalama Methanol Refinery is more than on its last legs. It's on its last toenail, basically, and that it's probably not going to be approved. I'm assuming that there'll be litigation like there was, or is still going on, for the Millennium Bulk Coal Terminal, which Dan Sears from Columbia Riverkeeper seems to think that. But I know that there's going to be a celebration tomorrow night in Kalama on the state, the closeness to victory that people feel. So I think a lot of people are feeling pretty positive about that one.
Yeah, and that will. I mean, it is a huge victory by any measure. I mean, that thing would have radically expanded the delivery of fracked gas from Canada down to the Lower Columbia River region. It probably would have built not just that project, but would have created the conditions for other projects to get built too. And so, stopping that, you know, when it is finally done, will be a huge victory for all of the activists who went to battle over that thing. It's a classic story of the fingering line in the Northwest, where, you know, when that project was, and when anybody started really paying attention to that project, it felt like it was a done deal. It felt like it was way too far gone. There was no way to stop it, and it was just going to get built. And, you know, and by hook or by crook, you know, it's the next year, and it's the next year, and all of a sudden it's 4 years later, and the thing is still not built. It's still tied up in permitting challenges. It's still tied up in review, and this is kind of sometimes these projects die quickly, but more often they die slowly, and I think that this is certainly one of the bigger victories that that this region has seen.
Well,
but not the last.
Speaking of dying slowly, let's talk a little bit about Jordan Cove.
Yeah.
Which has been dying for 15 years, but on the other hand, has been wreaking havoc down there. And
it's died twice, actually, and
yeah.
It's come back to life twice. And so I do think the third time is the charm on this one. And again, you may have to fill in some of the more sort of detailed recent issues with permitting and review. But, you know, overview on that one is, for those who don't know, it was originally designed, it was denied by the federal government already once. When the Trump administration came in, they really wanted to push this project through so that it, with obviously support from the industry, it got reinvigorated. It was then purchased by a big Canadian gas industry company called Pembina. And yet still it has got to survive both federal and state approval. And, you know, it is so far past its original completion date, so far over budget. And I think the odds makers on that one are going to say, you know, it's not going to get built either. When the ultimate resolution happens, I don't know, but it could be in 2020.
Well, actually, it was denied three times, because it was denied first when originally it was going to be an import terminal. That was denied because there was no need for it. And then it was denied twice as an export terminal, once in like early 2016 and then once about 3 weeks after Trump was elected. And of course, the third time it was denied, people didn't celebrate too hard because they knew that as soon as Trump was inaugurated, it would come back to life, and it did. But what's interesting to me is Pembina is trying to sell, I think, 60% of the whole project, and they've also cut their spending by about two thirds. They were spending $10 million a month on this, and now they're only spending, I think, $50 million for the year. So there's something going on there, and I've talked with activists down there about what it is, and nobody's quite sure, but it does look like they may be joining this campaign, the PR campaign up in Washington, to try to keep gas alive. So I think, I mean, you've been talking about the thin green line. I remember this event I went to in Vancouver, Washington, now must be like 5 years ago, where it was the Thin Green Line and Sacrifice Zones, and it was about Vancouver Energy, the oil terminal that was trying to get built in the Port of Vancouver. And you talked about what the Thin Green Line was and our successes. And you also, I remember another speech where you talked about these different doors that we could open and what would be behind each door. So do you think that we're opening the right door here?
I do. I mean, I don't. So, I mean, the sort of cautious and skeptical side of me says, Well, there's a lot that's not right yet, and that's true. But yes, we are opening the right doors in this region, and I love the example of Vancouver, Washington. I mean, this was a place that welcomed with open arms, you know, the world's largest oil by rail project. There was another one too, and that project looked like it was going to be done for sure, and not only did it not get built, but it changed the political composition of the community, and it changed it in a really positive way, where we have a crop of port commissioners and other leaders in that community who see that Vancouver, Washington, and every other place in the Northwest needs to be part of the solution and needs to be part of a climate-stable future and frankly, needs to protect themselves from the risks of the industry. And so, you know, that project died. It was trounced, actually, in the end. And it's not possible now to imagine another project like that coming back to Vancouver, Washington. And so the story, you know, that I told in Vancouver, I don't know, 5 years ago, whatever that was, and that I still tell, is that what's happening in the Northwest is it's not a story of just Seattle and just Portland, or it's not a story of a small number of people. It's like a fat green line now. It's communities all up and down the region that are moving ahead assertively to stop this stuff. And you know what's happening in Eugene now with gas, what's happening in Bellingham now with gas. This is like the next chapter of it. And so I find a lot of encouragement in seeing, you know, local leaders, even in places like Kalama, rise up and say, no, we're not going to become a petrochemical industry hub. That's ridiculous. And so this movement, it's bubbling now. And I think it's going to only get stronger as the imperatives of climate really become more and more apparent in 2020. And so that's the kind of thing that gives me a lot of hope is seeing this just resistance just rise up from every corner, it feels like. I know I'm sort of overstating it, but I think there's really a lot there that is factually based.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute. And we're trying to put a little bit of joy into this rather startling year that we've just begun. But yeah, I'm thinking about all these communities that have changed, and I've witnessed two of them pretty closely. In Kalama, the first time I went up to a hearing in Kalama, which was just about 3 years ago, and it was a hearing for the clean air permit for the Kalama methanol refinery. And though the room was maybe 50-50 pro and against the refinery, the elected officials were 100% in support of it, which really horrified me because I'd been spending all this time in Vancouver where the elected officials were totally against the oil terminal. And now, well, Kalama has, I mean, they have a mayor who's against the methanol refinery. A couple of people who ran for Port Commission and County Commission didn't win who were opponents of the methanol refinery. But you can see, I mean, at the hearing in Longview last year for the draft supplemental environmental impact statement, the room was filled, overwhelmingly filled with opponents, and hardly any of the proponents were let their faces be shown. So I could see a big difference there. Now, down in Coos Bay and across Southern Oregon, we're also seeing a transformation there. And I know there's a couple of progressive candidates who are running for county commission in Coos County in the coming election. And they're also in touch with people who we should be sort of tipping our hat to, which is the folks in Clatsop County who beat off a bazillion LNG facilities back starting 15 years ago and who have really transformed their community there. I don't know. Are you very familiar, Eric, with what happened in Astoria and Clatsop County back in?
I'm modestly familiar with it. Yeah, I mean, that was a long fight, as you say. It was, I guess, 15 years. And so Clatsop County, Astoria, and a lot of those folks, and actually, you know, Dan Sears is part of that story, too. You know, that in some ways that was kind of like the prequel to the Thin Green Line fight, and you're right, we should tip our hats to them more than we do. So thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, I mean they've actually they transformed their county commission in the middle of the fight, and it's absolutely impossible to imagine any projects like Oregon LNG or Bradwood Landing LNG being proposed now. And Astoria is a thriving, vibrant community with all these locally owned businesses. They don't allow any multinational big box stores in the city. They're all in Warrenton. But, you know, it's like Astoria has really come back to life after almost being snuffed out with the end of the fishing industry. So it's very positive to see. And I think a lot of what built Astoria into what it is now was the fight against LNG. So how do you see that the fights that are happening now in Kalama and Tacoma? Oh, and I think Tacoma also, we should mention that Christine Ang, who is a very strong opponent of Tacoma LNG, was elected to the Port Commission. And I think she is being sworn in right now, actually.
That's right. So you know, so I love Astoria, by the way. And quick plug for the Maritime Museum there. I just visited a couple weeks ago with my kid, and it's really a wonderful museum.
It
and
is,
I
yeah.
love Astoria, but I think it's the story is different in every location, and yet it's kind of the same too. Tacoma has undergone it is still undergoing its own political transformation on these issues. The first methanol project that we fought in the Northwest was actually twice as big as the one in Kalama, and it was cited for right in that downtown industrial port area in Tacoma, and that one. That basically ignited a firestorm politically in that city, and it was essentially run out of town on a rail. We've covered that ground, I think, before, but that was an exciting time, and it is still bearing fruit. And the Tacoma LNG, which is sort of the subsequent fight in that community, is still creating political shockwaves, and it is still in the process of kind of rearranging the political composition of the leadership in that city. That's really cool to see. You know, the other story I don't like to forget about is out on the Washington coast at Hoquiam, which was home to three oil by rail projects originally. And that was, you know, very much like you describing Kalama or Longview, where, you know, at first it was kind of a maybe more supporters, and then it was kind of a mixed bag. And then pretty soon it was, you'd go to those hearing rooms and it was all opposition and, you know, two or three guys in the back who were supporters, and they were, you know, usually in suits or something. You know, Hoquiam, they used they banned large scale oil storage, just banned it outright. So you couldn't now even imagine one of those projects coming back to Hoquiam, which sits, you know, at Grays Harbor in this really sort of fertile kind of fishing area. It's exciting to see this stuff happen, you know, again, sort of differently from place to place, because each place has its own history and culture and dynamics, but the trend is all the same. And I think that's really, really exciting to watch.
Well, I've sat around with Tacoma activists and watched them kind of plot out how to take back their government. And they figured, I mean, I would talk to them about what happened in Astoria, Clatsop County, and what happened in Vancouver. And at first they'd say, well, it's Vancouver's, you know, in the Portland shadow, and of course good things will happen there. But I think that in the course of time that I talked to them, they were really starting to think about how to take back the Port Commission, take back the City Council. And they have one Port Commissioner who is a visionary. But I think that's the beginning of a change. And so in some of the conversations I've had with them, they're really thinking long term. But one very depressing one I had with them, they were talking about how long it would take and realized by that time we're past the time where we can do anything about climate crisis. So how do we fit that little factor in, just to kind of bring us down for the last couple of minutes of the show?
And I'll try to keep us from getting too far down on that one. You know, it's right that the pace of political change is often much, much, and it's increasingly clear that it's far too slow to address the urgency of climate change. And so, you know, it is not the case that we can wait for every community to one by one kind of develop a more climate forward thinking leadership. That's going to happen anyway, but we do need a whole bunch of new tools and a whole bunch of new ideas. And I think, you know, to sort of tie it back to the beginning of the program, that's why it's exciting to see Greta on the cover of Time magazine. That's why it's exciting to see this whole sort of indigenous-led and youth-led movement come up, because what they are asking for, what they're demanding actually, is something that goes far beyond the existing kind of political rubric that we have. It is climate action right now, and it is sort of climate action damn the consequences. It is, we have to decarbonize immediately. And you know, we don't have, you know, is the environmental impact statement the right tool for that? It helps, but no, we need something more dramatic. And so I am waiting with bated breath to see how that kind of that indigenous-led and youth-led, those movements, which are kind of interlinked, that's going to be, I think, the next generation of the Thin Green Line, and I think it is going to be awesome to watch. And so, I'm sympathetic to the Tacoma activists. They've been doing great work and making great progress. It's not fast enough, maybe, but there is a whole kind of army right behind us that is about to step into power, and I think it's exciting to watch.
And I think we can learn an awful lot from them. I think about how there's this moment where suddenly you have a totally different way of thinking about things than you ever thought you could. And I guess the question is, how do we get ourselves there or open ourselves so that we are ready to see what the future can really be?
Yeah, I think that is a great question, and maybe a great question for everyone to ponder, because I don't know what the answer is, quite honestly. I think it is going to be, you know, on some level, there's a role for people like me at a think tank who do some research and analysis and some outreach and other stuff, but it's on some level it's a peer-to-peer thing, it's a person-to-person, it's a community-to-community thing, and I think it's that kind of intense personal connection, even one-on-one, is what will begin to kind of reshape the future in the Northwest, and I really hope for the future outside the Northwest too.
Well, I really hope so too, and this is a good way to start the year, so I'm really glad to talk with you this morning, Eric.
Likewise, Barbara. It's so good to be on.
We've been talking today with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be talking with Mark Wynn, who's author of Food Town USA. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some sounds of one of the high points for me this past year in political activism, singing in the Capitol Rotunda in Salem on November 21st as people, landowners and indigenous people and activists opposing Jordan Cove stormed the Capitol, and over 100 of them sat in at the governor's office. Thanks for listening, and have a happy new year.